From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
He gave his life to save his fellow Americans. He didn't care whether they were Muslim or Christian or Jew or Hindu or any other faith. He just went down to help, you know. And he lost his life.
Today is the second anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. As the world's attention is focused on Ground Zero, we spend the hour looking at September 11th throughout history. September 11th, 1990, from one Ground Zero to another, Guatemala. The military in Guatemala assassinates anthropologist Myrna Mack.
My name is Helen Mack. I'm sister of Myrna Mack, who was an anthropologist who was murdered in September 11th of 1990 by the death squad of the Presidential High Command.
September 11th, 1977. South African leader Stephen Biko is beaten and then murdered by South African security forces.
Well, my father was arrested in 1977 on August 18th, coming back from a trip in Cape Town.
September 9th through 13th, 1971. More than 100 men are wounded and killed by New York State troopers during the Attica uprising.
I am telling you that the governor of New York State premeditatedly set up the assault force, and they came in that yard indiscriminately shooting. I'm not telling you about what somebody told me. I'm telling you about what I know.
And September 11th, 1973, 30 years ago today, the democratically elected leader in Chile, Salvador Allende, dies in the palace as the U.S.-backed Pinochet forces rise to power.
By a blood-chilling coincidence, historic karma, the commandeered airplane struck the U.S. targets on a Tuesday, September 11th, exactly the same day of the week and month, and almost at the same time in the morning of the 1973 military coup in Chile, a terrorist attack orchestrated by the CIA against a democracy.
From one Ground Zero to another, September 11th through history. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On the eve of this September 11th, President Bush has called for the first time for Congress to expand the controversial USA Patriot Act by lowering the standard for investigators to obtain subpoenas to search homes, increase the number of crimes that carry the death penalty, and allow for people to be held without bail. Bush made the announcement one day after Attorney General John Ashcroft completed a 10-day tour trying to increase support for the original Patriot Act, which has been condemned by 159 towns, cities, and counties. The House also last month voted to restrict portions of the Patriot Act. Despite this opposition, Bush is pushing for even more governmental power. The Senate yesterday voted to reject the proposed changes in the nation's overtime laws that could have stripped up to 8 million workers' overtime pay. In another surprise legislative move, the House voted to relax provisions of the Cuban trade embargo to allow U.S. tourists to travel to Cuba. Bush is expected to veto both provisions. In Enron news, former Treasurer Ben Glisson has become the company's first executive to be jailed for involvement in the firm's massive financial scandal. Yesterday, he began his five-year jail term. And yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld spoke at the National Press Club. He got an unexpected response from part of the crowd. Let's take a listen.
The attack coalition forces were responding in Afghanistan to remove the Taliban and put al-Qaeda on the run in a matter of months.
Mr. Rumsfeld, you're fired. Your foreign policy is based on lies. The war in Iraq was unjust and illegal, and the occupation is immoral. There are U.S. soldiers dying in Iraq every day. Still dying. Bring the troops home now.
When are they coming
home? Go home.
Tell us when the troops are coming home. They need to come home. Hey, Hatfield, what do you say? How many troops did you kill today? Hey, Rumsfeld, what do you say? How many soldiers did you kill today? Hey,
protesters disrupting Donald Rumsfeld's address yesterday at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. They were taken out of the room by security. And before we begin our September 11th special, we are going to go briefly to the streets of Cancun, where thousands are protesting the World Trade Organization. Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films is there and prepared this report for Democracy Now!
The morning of September 10th, 10,000 farmers from around the world gathered here in Cancun, Mexico to march on the WTO. Vicente, a Brazilian organizer with the MST, explained the protests. We fight the WTO to free our people. In Brazil, in the last 8 years, more than 900,000 farmers have been expelled from their land. The powerful are armed, but they are few, and our weapons are more powerful than theirs. They cannot kill our ideas, they cannot kill our truths, they cannot deny our right to fight for our life. September 10th is the Day of the Dead in Korea, and a delegation of more than 100 Korean farmers attempted to carry a symbolic coffin to the WTO Convention Center to protest policies they say are destroying farming in Korea. But riot police behind an 8-foot steel fence blocked the march at the entrance to the hotel zone. Lee Kyung-hai, a 55-year-old farmer, climbed onto the police barricades and chanted to the crowd, "The WTO kills farmers." After leading the crowd in chants, Lee stabbed himself and fell into the crowd. He died in the hospital a few hours later. As their comrade was driven to the hospital, protesters ripped through the fence and tried to fight their way through the police lines. They snatched shields from police and fought with sticks, rocks in their hands. Police responded with batons, threw stones into the crowd, and attempted to wrestle the fence away from protesters. The barricade was flipped over, back onto police lines, but protesters did not push into the hotel zone. As dusk fell over Cancun and the city reeled from the day's events, the flag of the Korean Farmers Association was raised over Cancun General Hospital, and people gathered to remember Lee and his sacrifice. His friends and comrades described him as a quiet and sensitive father of two, but insisted that his death was not a personal tragedy, that Lee died fighting for life, and his death was part of a system of violence that kills and displaces hundreds of millions of farmers and peasants. They demanded that the meetings be stopped out of respect for the dead, both here in Cancun and around the world. For Democracy Now!, this is Rick Rowley reporting from the real Cancun.
And finally, this news from Stockholm. The Swedish foreign minister, Anna Lindh, touted as a future prime minister, has been killed today, died of stab wounds, the second Swedish politician to be murdered in the Scandinavian country in 17 years in a rare act of public violence. Lindh died at 5:29 this morning from severe internal bleeding and injuries to her stomach and liver after she was knifed in an upscale Stockholm department store by an unknown assailant.
This is a poem about what causes poems like this to be written. And if this is a 9/11 poem, then this is a September 11, 1973 poem for Chile. This is a September 12, 1977 poem for Stephen Biko in South Africa. This is a September 13, 1971 poem for the brothers at Attica Prison, New York. This is a September 14, 1992 poem for the people of Somalia. This is a poem for every date that falls to the ground amidst the ashes of amnesia. This is a poem for the 110 stories that were never told, the 110 stories that history uprooted from its textbooks, the 110 stories that CNN, BBC, The New York Times, and Newsweek ignored. This is a poem for interrupting this program.
And that was Emmanuel Ortiz reading his poem on this day, 2 years after the September 11th attacks, as we go back in time.
The latest news we have is that There have been widespread attacks that include at least 3 commercial jet crashes. We now believe perhaps 4, 3 commercial jet crashes into significant buildings. In the first attack, a plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan shortly before 9 o'clock, followed by another plane into the second tower about 20 minutes later. Both towers later collapsed. About an hour later, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, part of which later collapsed. American Airlines told CNN that it lost 2 planes in tragic accidents. Flight 11 from Boston with 81 passengers and 11 crew aboard, and Flight 77 from Washington Dulles Airport with 58 passengers and 6 crew aboard. Both planes were en route to Los Angeles. United Airlines Flight 93 airliner headed from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco crashed near Somerset, Pennsylvania. Police said initial reports indicated no survivors. It was not known if this was connected to the attacks. United also said it was deeply concerned about Flight 175 from Boston to Los Angeles. The Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, the Justice Department, the Capitol, the CIA, and all other government buildings in Washington have been evacuated. President Bush canceled an appearance in Florida to return to
listening to 2 years ago, the report on September 11th, 2001. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, 2 years ago today at 8:47, American Airlines Flight 11 out of Boston crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center, tearing a gaping hole in the building and setting it afire. At 9:03 a.m., a second plane, United Flight 175, also from Boston, crashed into the South Tower. Both buildings were ablaze. At 9:43, American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. At 10:10 in the morning, United Airlines Flight 93 crashed in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. Some 2,792 people died at the World Trade Center, 184 at the Pentagon, and 40 in the crash in Pennsylvania. More than 90 nations lost citizens in these attacks as the world's attention is focused on the site now known as Ground Zero, just blocks from our firehouse studios here in Chinatown. We continue with part two of Democracy Now!'s special 3-day 911 coverage.
September 11th has now become synonymous with tragic events of 2 years ago. It brings forth images of the death and destruction here in the U.S., the towers crumbling, people fleeing through streets or jumping from buildings, people desperate to learn anything about their missing loved ones. But for others around the world, this date evokes different images and memories of terror. Today on Democracy Now!, we'll spend the hour looking at September 11th throughout history. We'll go back to September 11th, 1973, the day Chile's democratically elected President Salvador Allende was killed in a CIA-backed military coup, to September 11th, 1977, the day anti-apartheid leader Stephen Biko was being driven to Pretoria, where he would die a day later on a prison floor after being beaten by South African police. To September 11, 1990, when Guatemalan anthropologist Myron Mack was murdered by U.S.-backed death squads. To September 11, 1971, to the Attica prison uprising that saw New York State troopers kill 39 men and wound 88 others.
Today, though, we'll begin our show with the most recent September 11th attacks. Last night, I spent the evening with the parents of a young man who died in the World Trade Center 2 years ago today. They were two of the hundreds of victims' families who marched from Union Square in New York to the spot where the Twin Towers once stood. Standing in front of Ground Zero last night, Pakistani immigrants Talat Hamdani and her husband Salim remembered their son Salman as a hero, a New York City police cadet who died attempting to save lives at the World Trade Center 2 years ago this morning. Here is Talat Hamdani, Salman's mother, describing her son as she stood at the site where he died.
He gave his life to save his fellow Americans. He didn't care whether they were Muslim or Christian or Jew or Hindu or any other faith, or whether they were Chinese or American or Afghani or Liberian for all I know. He just went down to help, you know, and he lost his life.
Even though their son was singled out by President Bush and mentioned by name in the USA Patriot Act as a hero, that was not how their son was portrayed in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The New York Post and other media outlets portrayed Salman as a possible terrorist on the run. In a moment, we'll hear more about the story of how Salman went from suspected terrorist to hero. But first, we begin with Talat Hamdani, Salman's mother, describing September 11, 2001.
I was in school, actually, you know. I was in school that day, so I got the news at about 10:30 when I came out of the classroom. I saw teachers huddled over, you know, talking about the Twin Towers, you know, being attacked. So I called home to my husband. I said, they must be crazy. So when I called home, my husband was on the other end. And he said, the Twin Towers collapsed and Salman is there. So I told him he didn't work there. He wouldn't be there. He works in Manhattan. So don't worry. He's not downtown or near the towers anyway. So you don't have to worry about him, you know. And I got home right about 4:30 because we had to volunteer to keep the children in school safely till they were picked up by their parents. So when I got home, we tried to contact him on his cell, Salman, but he wasn't answering. And then I remembered the day before when he came home, he had forgotten his cell phone on the job. He worked at Rockefeller, which is 65 Street and York Avenue. So being the type of person that he was, an EMT and a police cadet, and apart from being an EMT and police cadet, he a very, you know, kind person, very generous, very helpful. We knew he would go down to help over there. I mean, if he saw such a disaster, he would respond to it. There was a call given out for all the EMTs to come forward for the rescue help. And finally, his brother, my husband's brother, went to his office and they told him he never reported to work. And we waited for him to call home that night. The first night, I wasn't worried. My husband was. I wasn't worried, but then, so the next, that's how the day went by, you know, just waiting for him to call, and the call that never came.
The next day, September 12th, what did you do?
Well, I called in my school. I told them I'm not coming. My son hasn't come home. And we went down to his office. We decided to go to his office, retrieve his cell phone. We were both very shattered, very distraught. We were crying. They tried their best to help us out. And there was a security guard over there, the security of the building. He says he knows people in the FBI. He'll give them our son's name. Maybe they will be able to find him if he's helping down there. And then from there, we went down to St. Vincent's Hospital, I think it was, to look at the list of people missing and the hospital's list, patient list. And finally, you know, he was neither on the dead list nor on the patient list. So that was very encouraging, you know, that everything is okay. Hopefully he'll call in today. And we went home like about 8 p.m., very tired and exhausted, but more disappointed, and reality started to hit us at that moment. Something did happen to him. And the third day we went down to the center that they had made for the families to come and write their, give their names of their loved ones. Armory it was, yes, it was the Armory. We went down there and we registered his name and we gave our swab samples for the DNA. And we made a flyer searching for him. We put down his name as Sal Hamdani. My brother did not put down his name, the first name Muhammad, for certain reasons. And we searched for him. Nobody had seen him. We went down the following weeks. We went down to the ground zero itself, asking the firemen, showing them his picture. Maybe they saw him. But nobody saw him at all. And then it was just a search. Everywhere in hospitals, we went to New Jersey. We went to all the hospitals. Because there were patients, you know, who had lost their memory. You know, maybe we hoped that he would be one of them. We would be able to identify him, but we couldn't go through. They wouldn't let us see. They just said there were 6 or 7 patients came and they all left. They were all discharged. We got a list of hospitals, like 151 hospitals, to go and find out about him. If it could be in any one of them, they told us. That list was given by the Red Cross from the armory.
What made you think from the first day, even though he didn't work at the World Trade Center, that he was there that first morning as you were watching the television?
Actually, I was sleeping that time, you know, and my sister-in-law, she called me and she said, did you hear something? I said, no. And she said that one tower already fell down. And the first word from my mouth was that, oh my God, my son is there.
When did you first have contact with the authorities and how did it change? At first looking for your son, believing he was at Ground Zero since he didn't call.
What happened was we decided to go to Mecca, you know, to pray over there. And the day before the departure, I said, you know, they were announcing, come down and identify your loved ones, their bodies over there. So I said, you know, I summed up enough courage to call them up and ask them, where is the mortuary? And I want to go down there and see them, see the dead bodies, you know. God forbid, maybe he's there instead. And we're traveling from here. So when I called over there, they asked me, who are you looking for? And he's a British citizen. I said, no, he's not a British citizen. Why did the British demand him that he is a British? I said, my sister came from Britain, so she must have told the embassy, you know, that she's traveling for this purpose. And then they said he's also registered on the Pakistani list. I said, yeah, because we originally came from Pakistan. But right now we are all American citizens. So they said, okay, we'll consolidate the information and we'll help you find your son. But the armory has moved, you know, the center has moved from here to somewhere in Pier 51 or some such thing uptown, you know, midtown, wherever. And so that was a Saturday, and I think it was a Saturday, whatever day it was. And whoever that officer was, he called us like 3-4 times on our cell, trying to gather information where my son worked and what time he left home, what time he got back. That was like four or five days before going to Mecca. No, 3 days before going to Mecca. And then the day we were leaving, these reporters came home, you know. First the New York Post guy came home, and then shortly later, you know, the Daily News guy came, and then I think the Newsday. So I asked them, you know, why are you all here again? Now what happened? It was a month later, October 11th. So I says, what happened? What brings you back to our house? So they told us there's a flyer circulating amongst the NYPD with your son's cadet picture on it. If anyone has seen him, to come forward, we need some information about him. And then we left for Mecca, and when we were there, my sisters told us that, you know, this is what the newspaper, the Post, printed a very horrible heading, you know, missing or hiding. And amongst the news, that the way they presented it, it had, you know, insinuations that he was seen near the, at 11 a.m. he was seen near the Midtown Tunnel. And is he really hiding? Most probably, is he really missing? He's not missing, but he's hiding, and he could be one of the terrorists. I have that article.
And so what came of this, missing or hiding, suggesting that he was a terrorist? What did the authorities do then, and how did you feel?
The authorities, what authorities? Who would take action? Who do you think should take action against the newspaper? You tell me.
Talat and Mohammed Hamdani, the mother and father of Salman Hamdani, killed in the World Trade Center 2 years ago, speaking to us last night in the procession from Union Square to New York, in New York, to Ground Zero. The article from the New York Post she was speaking of was from October 12, 2001. It was called Missing or Hiding, Mystery of NYPD Cadet from Pakistan.
Here's an excerpt from that article. Quote, the NYPD is hunting for one of its former cadets initially reported missing in the Twin Towers attack, issuing an urgent hold and detain order for the Pakistani native. Hamdani was last seen, Quran in hand, leaving his Bayside Queens home for his job as a research assistant at Rockefeller University, but he never made it to work. But investigators for the FBI and NYPD have since questioned the family about which internet chat rooms he visited and if he was political. Police sources said he hadn't been to work at the NYPD since April, but he still carried official identification. One source told the Post, quote, "That tells me they're not looking for this guy at the bottom of the rubble. The thing that bothers me is if he's up to some tricks, he can walk past anybody using the ID card." Hamdani's mother, who has been in the United States for 2 decades, denied her son was political or a religious fundamentalist. Cops at the Midtown Tunnel reported spotting someone who looked like Hamdani yesterday morning.
We're going to come back to the Hamdanis in a minute.
When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call, hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home.
Mm-hmm. Odetta, singing last year in our Firehouse studio here at Downtown Community Television on the first anniversary of September 11th. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 11 days after the New York Post article was written about Salman Hamdani, called Missing or Hiding, Mystery of NYPD Cadet from Pakistan, Congress passed the Patriot Act, singling out Salman as a hero. We return now to our interview with his mother, Talat Hamdani.
We wrote a letter to President Bush, appealing him to help us find our son. And if they have detained him for whatever reason, just let us know, because, you know, what has to be done for the national defense and security has to be done, like they say. But, you know, if you have him, inform us. So we wrote a letter to President Bush.
Did you get a response?
We got a response in January. And the response was that we have forwarded your request to the FBI, I think. And then a week later, like 5 days later, we got a letter from the FBI that we only investigate people who have done some crime. So if your child has done a crime, inform us, which of course there's nothing wrong that he has done. We did call all the prisons, the federal, that they realized there are federal prisons and there are state prisons and there are local prisons. And we called everywhere, you know.
Tell me about March 20th.
So we were living in this hope that, you know, one day he's going to come home, because his name was not on the medical examiner's, you know, list of dead people. And there was no way that, according to our logical reasoning, that he could have arrived there within that time frame on that chaotic day. We had the hope he will be coming home. And then there were these stories also, factual ones, that people were who you know, detained, and people were being deported, illegal people, immigrants, whoever. So on March 20th, we were sitting home, you know, and then 11:30 p.m. it was, two officers came from the 111 precinct, and they came into the house. We were both standing in the kitchen, and as soon as they came in, they says, your son is dead. He has been identified through DNA. Call this number at the medical examiner's office. Do it right now. And so he just sat down on the floor crying. And so I told them, you know, I told him, don't believe what they say. And they said, you don't believe us? I says, no, I don't believe you. No, I call them right now. I says, we'll do whatever we have to do whenever we feel like. And they left, and we thought about what to do. And calling the family again at midnight didn't make sense, and just to disturb them again as much as we were disturbed. So we went to sleep, and in the morning we got up and we told our family. And we went to California to my sister because I knew reporters would come again. And I didn't have the courage then to stand in front of all those, you know, people and talk about this event. But now I have the courage.
When did you have the ceremony for him at the mosque?
April 5th. We had it on April 5th because family members, my sister, his brother, his sister, you know, they had to come from Pakistan, from Dubai. So we had it on April 5th. It was a Friday. We had it in the mosque in Manhattan, where he used to go and pray every Friday.
At his funeral, at the ceremony at the mosque, the mayor came?
Mayor Bloomberg came. Commissioner Kelly came. My brother contacted the NYPD, requesting them how to handle his funeral services, and the department said they will handle it. So the police department handled from there onwards.
Because he was a police cadet?
Because he was the police cadet. And Congressman Ackerman came. While we were in Mecca, Ackerman's office had contacted our home to help us find our son. So we were in close touch with him. So he came to the services also, and he brought a flag with him, which was flown on top of Capitol Hill in Salman's name. And Commissioner Kelly also came, a wonderful man. Last year, after the, you know, March 20th, I requested him to give me a shield in my son's honor as in remembrance. And he honored us last year, first anniversary. You know, he made a shield in his name, Lieutenant Shield. He said never it has happened in the history of, you know, NYPD.
How do you feel saying that his first name is Muhammad now?
His first name...
It's difficult times right now. Difficult times. Not that we experienced any such thing, but we have nieces and nephews in second and third grade. They were that time. They were in second grade. And believe me, they changed their names. You know, some Armin became Amy, and one became Mickey, and the other one became Mikey. And the fourth one became Adam. And we asked them why you changed their names. And they said, you know, because we don't want to be called terrorists in the school. We are Muslims. So there was a natural backlash. I faced it in my classroom. The kids also spoke about it. I gave them a do now, you know, define a terrorist, you know, what do you call it? I brainstormed them, you know, define a terrorist. And the first word everybody echoed was Muslim. And then I told them, you know, second brainstorm topic was define, you know, Islam. And the first word that they came up with was Bin Laden. So it came at that moment, you know, like a year and a half ago, like Islam and terrorism were synonymous terms. And that is where I find myself defending myself, my faith, my people, my community, my fellow Americans who are Muslims. Islam and terrorism are not synonymous. And if they are synonymous, they're as much synonymous as any other faith. As any other faith. And it is the ignorant people. I was so amazed when one of the pastors from some in the South said, you know, that Islam, to his own priest, group of priests, that Islam is a religion of terror. And I said, you know, it's a shame that he had to say that without reading the Quran. And he said, he apologized. He said, it was only meant for my people, not for the world to hear that. Isn't that prejudice?
We wanted to have you in the studio when we did this interview this morning of September 11th. You won't be in New York at this time. Why?
I don't want to relive that again, what happened last year and 2 years ago. It's traumatic. It's very traumatic for me, you know. In my mind, my family says I'm in denial. Maybe I am. If that's the way I can survive, why not? If I don't think of him as dead, I just think of him as gone away to his work, or maybe he's in London doing his studies. But I feel at peace at home.
Talat Hamdani, standing with her husband Mohammed, remembering their son Salman, who died at the World Trade Center 2 years ago today. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we continue with this Democracy Now! Special from one Ground Zero to another, from one September 11th to another, 30 years ago today, September 11th, 1973, the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende, died in the palace as he was overthrown in a bloody CIA-backed military coup led by General Augusto Pinochet, who then reigned for 17 years, overseeing the killing of more than 3,000 Chileans until 1990, the coup backed by then-President Richard Nixon and Secretary of State National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. President Salvador Allende was honored yesterday in a ceremony at the palace where he was assassinated 30 years ago.
In 1998, Pinochet was arrested in London on torture and genocide charges on a warrant issued by a Spanish judge. British authorities eventually released him after doctors ruled him physically and mentally unfit to stand trial. This past August, current Chilean President Ricardo Lagos announced a plan to pay compensation to thousands of families who had relatives killed during Pinochet's military regime. We turn now to Vladimir Vega, a refugee from Chile living in London who spent 5 years in prison during the Pinochet regime. And after the September 11th attacks, he sent a letter to the victims here in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Vladimir.
Yeah, thank you.
Could you tell us what you said in your letter to the victims here in the United States?
I can read an extract of it, which is basically to tell them that they were not alone, that the family of those who died in New York had brothers in suffering and pain in another country, small country, a poor country, and that basically were... through a traumatic years of dictatorship, because of the intervention of the Nixon administration in the affairs of our country. If I may, I can read an extract now. It says that in September 1970, we all went to vote and we won. There was milk and education for the children. Unused land was given to landless peasants. Coal, copper, and the main industry became owned by all of us. For the first time in their lives, people had dignity. But we did not know how dangerous that was. The Secretary, Henry Kissinger, announced, "I don't see why we should stand by and let a country go communist due to the responsibility of its own people. Our democratic decisions, our votes, were not relevant. The market and the profit are more important than democracy. From that moment onwards, our pain, your pain, was legalized." I think that in a way, makes a bit of history saying what we wanted, which was our dream to own our own economy. And also, it tells a little bit about what happened to us was in percentage due to the attitude and the decision taken in the White House in those years between mainly in 1970 when Allende was elected. All that, at the end, led up to our Tuesday, 11th September 11, which in which so many people died, in which I was also injured, and I was taken to prison and beaten up.
Well, Vladimir Vega, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this on the September 11th to impart part of your message to the American people that you sent originally back 2 years ago. We're also joined by Peter Kornbrew, who's the author of the Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. It's a huge book that looks at all of the declassified documents relating to the coup in Chile. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me on the show on this dramatic and tragic anniversary.
And Peter, ironically, I remember having you on 2 years ago to this day as the planes were hitting the World Trade Center. We were talking about more declassified documents in the case of the anniversary of the coup in Chile.
Yes, we were. And the fact that there was a lawsuit being filed against Henry Kissinger by the Chilean family whose father had been shot in a CIA plot. I remember that conversation well.
Could you give us just a quick summary of some of the major things that you've brought out in this new book?
Well, the book covers 20 kind of dramatic and dense years of U.S. policy towards Chile. First, U.S. efforts to undermine democracy in Chile between 1970 and 1973, and then the history of U.S. Efforts to bolster the Pinochet regime and the evolution of the U.S. posture towards Pinochet, particularly after he sent his a team of terrorists here to Washington, D.C. to kill his leading critic, Orlando Letelier, and at the same time killing an American colleague of Letelier's, Ronnie Carpen Moffat. The declassified documents really shed considerable light on Kissinger and Nixon's motives in opposing Allende, the actions the CIA took, and the really secret history of U.S. efforts in the hours after Pinochet's coup to communicate with him and assure him of Washington's support for his new regime.
Peter Kornbluh, we're going to come back to discuss this more. Today we're taking a journey through a number of September 11th through history, and we thank you for being with us today, author of The Pinochet File, A Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability, and Vladimir Vega, who survived the Pinochet years, fortunately backed by the U.S. military in prison for 5 years and then left the country after he was released, living in London. You're listening to Democracy Now! We come back, we go back to September 11th, 1970. Seven in South Africa to Steve Biko's death. Biko, Peter Gabriel, here on Democracy Now! On this special second anniversary of September 11th in the United States as we travel from one September 11th to another, now going back to September 11th, 1977. South African police were transporting Stephen Biko, the leader of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, more than 700 miles to Pretoria. He was lying naked and chained on the floor of the police van the entire journey after being beaten unconscious early in the morning of September 12th. He died of brain damage on the floor of his prison cell. We go now to his son, who we reached at the airport in South Africa, Nkosinathi Biko, to talk about what happened in 1977 to his father, Stephen Biko.
Well, my father was arrested in 1977 on August 18th
coming back from a trip in Cape Town, where he had set out to bring about unity between the various political formations, the African National Congress, the Black Consciousness Movement, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the New Unity Movement. On his way back, he was arrested at a roadblock and taken into custody. And between that period and September 7th, he sustained massive injuries on his head. On September 11th, his condition had deteriorated to such an extent that he was transported over a journey of 1,000 kilometers in a police van without medical escort and in the condition that he was, and he died on September 12th. This year, of course, marks the 26th anniversary of his death.
Can you talk about the significance of your father and South African history, not to mention what the loss meant to you?
Well, I think that he was very instrumental in redefining the way we viewed ourselves as a nation. I think that he spoke a lot about the need for Black people to be central in defining and articulating their own aspirations, and that nobody was going to lead them out of the oppression that they were under. And I think that it happened at a very, very key time in South African politics, because there began to be a political lull, having the ANC and the Pan-Africanist Congress having been banned in the 60s. So his contribution, which comes in the late 60s and through the 70s, brought about, I think, a new energy that led, of course, to the what we called rolling mass action of the 80s and ultimately to the collapse of apartheid in the early 90s.
Nkosinathi Biko, remembering his father, Stephen Biko, leader of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, murdered by South African forces September 11th, 12th, 1977, as we move from one ground zero to another, from one September 11th to another. Juan?
On September 11th, 1990, renowned Guatemalan anthropologist Myrna Mack was assassinated in Guatemala City. She had been stalked for 2 weeks prior to her death by a U.S.-backed military death squad. Myrna had been targeted in retaliation for her pioneering field work, which had begun to expose and document the destruction of rural indigenous communities in Guatemala. Guatemala's U.S.-backed state forces and allied paramilitary groups were responsible for tens of thousands of human rights violations, including attacks against indigenous populations.
For over 12 years, Myrna's sister, Helen Mack, has fought tirelessly to bring justice to people who were killed by high-ranking Guatemalan officials in the armed forces. In 1991, Helen Mack initiated and pursued a private prosecution in Guatemala of those responsible for the assassination of her sister, Myrna Mack. It was the first human rights case during the time before the Guatemala courts. Her efforts led to the groundbreaking 1993 conviction of one of Myrna's attackers. Later, her efforts led to the indictment and trial of two colonels and a general, the highest-ranking officials in Guatemala ever to face trial for human rights violations. We go now to Guatemala City to Helen Mack, the sister of murdered Myrna Mack, the Guatemalan anthropologist. Welcome to Democracy Now, Helen.
Good morning, and thank you.
Your thoughts on this September 11th, as we unite in tragedy from New York, Ground Zero, to you in Guatemala.
Yes. 13 years ago, my sister was stabbed 27 times by a death squad from the Presidential High Command. And we've been trying to throw out the impunity, but on May 7th, the tribunal, even we had direct evidence of their responsibility, they were acquitted on May 7th of this year.
And your thoughts in terms of that the peace accords were reached in Guatemala, and yet we're seeing the return now of some of the most horrific of those leaders, for instance, General Efraín Ríos Montt coming back to political prominence and in Guatemala. What are your thoughts on the situation there?
Well, it's very terrible because my sister was killed in the framework of the peace negotiations, and the army never never have accepted the peace agreements, and even the civilian government was wondering to humanize the conflict. The militaries didn't, so she was killed in that framework. And now they still don't accept the peace agreements. Even her research and her studies were very useful for the resettlement agreement and other kind of agreements for the displaced people. They still reject it, and that's why the peace agenda in Guatemala after 8 years it has been coming down.
Well, Helen Mack, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Helen Mack, the sister of Myrna Mack. She is the Guatemalan anthropologist who was murdered by the Guatemalan military on September 11th, 1990, as we continue in our journey to September 11th around the world.
32 years ago today, on September 11th, the Attica prison in upstate New York was in the middle of a five-day uprising. Nearly 1,300 prisoners took control of the prison to protest the inhumane treatment at the facility. The unnamed prisoners took control of for 4 days and held 39 guards hostage. There was no attempted escape. Negotiations between the inmates and the state took place. Then on September 13th, then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered armed state troopers to raid the prison.
It would become one of the bloodiest days of the 20th century in the United States. Troopers shot indiscriminately over 2,000 rounds of ammunition. 39 men would die, 29 prisoners, 10 guards. After the shooting stopped, police beat and tortured scores of more prisoners. 90 of the surviving prisoners were seriously wounded, but were initially denied medical care. And the New York State would originally claim all the guards had died at the hands of the prisoners. The New York Times reported on its front page, the throats of all the guards were slashed. It was lies. The guards had been shot dead during the raid by the New York State troopers. After a quarter a century of legal struggles, the state of New York would eventually award the surviving prisoners of Attica $12 million in damages. We're going to close today's September 11th special by broadcasting an excerpt from the film Ghosts of Attica, a Lumiere production, which was made for Court TV. The story is told by Frank Big Black Smith, the prisoner who played a prominent role in the rebellion and who was tortured by the troops, and Liz Fink, who served as the lead counsel for the former Attica prisoners.
I heard a helicopter. The helicopter says, lay down, put your hands on your head, you will not be harmed. And I complied.
And they had us boxed in, and they were shooting down at us.
I couldn't crawl. I literally couldn't crawl.
Do not harm the hostages. Surrender peacefully. You will not be harmed.
I remember an inmate said, this guy is bleeding, he's bleeding, he's bleeding. And I didn't know what he was referring to me.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, you got to tell him that.
Just, you know, everywhere you looked around, all you seen was killing and shooting everything that came across.
People laying all over now, all bleeding and bloody and stuff. You know, so everybody know now that is real, that this is it. You know, they're here now. They in the yard now. They got control.
State troopers just took their clubs and beat them down the stairs. Broke people's legs, hit them on the tibia and broke tibias. On their back, on their head, in their genitals, on their front. You know, wherever they could hit them, that's where they beat them.
I'm telling you, my name is being called. Where's Big Black? Where's Big Black? Get up, Black, get up. And he busted me with a nigger stick, pickaxe, and got a 38 in his hand. And I gets up, and he bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, two, three more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me. And now they made me spread eagle on the table. here I am laying down looking up at the catwalk, and cigarettes and spit and shells after they shoot their gun, they're dropping them down on me. And I'm there with the football up under my chin. That football better stay there, because if it falls, you're going to die sooner than you expect to die. I'm not in charge now. You know, I'm back to their reality. They're going to show the humiliation that they're doing to me, everybody in the yard. Here's your security chief. What do you got to say about it now?
They got mad, wanted to teach the lesson to their third world population, and let all this evil go down. You have at least 88 people who are shot so severely that they need immediate surgery. There was absolutely no preparation made to treat the inmates. No blood, no plasma, no bandages, no fluids, no painkillers, no surgical, nothing. Nothing was done. L.D. Barkley was shot. The shot went through and it collapsed his lung. He couldn't get medical treatment. And he bled to death.
An excerpt of Ghosts of Attica, a Lumiere production for Court TV made by Brad Lichtenstein and David Van Taylor. If you want more information on that film, you can contact First Run Icarus Films. And one more September 11th in history as we conclude our September 11th special.
Yes, on September 11th, 1851, 37 African-American members of an anti-slavery militia and one white Quaker abolitionist in Pennsylvania were charged with treason under the Fugitive Slave Law after someone killed a slave owner who was trying to capture two fugitive slaves. On September 11th, 1897, the newly formed United Mine Workers of America ended a 10-week strike of 75,000 coal miners in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. The miners won an 8-hour workday and semi-monthly pay. A day earlier, 20 striking miners were killed. On September 11th, 1922, Britain's mandate over Palestine began, and the Arabs declared a day of mourning. On September 11, 1941, construction began on the Pentagon to house the then-named War Department. September 11, 1965, the 1st Cavalry Division arrives in South Vietnam. It is the first full military division to be deployed to fight in that war. Over 3 million Vietnamese would end up dying in the war that would continue for another decade. And on September 11, 1992, President H.W. Bush announced he was approving the sale of 72 F-15 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia.
That was George the First. And that does it for today's program. For New Yorkers interested in expressing their feelings about September 11th or Iraq or Afghanistan, you're invited to go tonight to Washington Square Park at 5:30. There will be a live national telecast being broadcast by our hosts here at the Firehouse, Downtown Community Television. Just look for the big blue cybercar bus. And that does it for the program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing, tireless, dedicated team. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Pervez Sharma, Jeremy Scahill, Anna Noguera, and Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.